Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Hour number two, what's up? Tiki and Tierney here, CBS Sports Radio. And we're coming to you from our Rocket Mortgage studio. When you want the ability to adjust your loan options in real time, Rocket can. Pretty stacked this hour. Baseball kicking around as they have with many things. Experimentally incorporating things into the lower levels of the minors, trying to change the game a little bit, trying to evolve, trying to tweak. Well, they are throwing a dart at a particular board in regards to one thing that they're pondering. And if it sticks, the game could look really, really different and a lot better. Teague and I will have that. And I already love the game, you know that, but it could look a lot better. We'll get to that coming up next segment. Also, Ben Simmons' comments about the DPOY, about the matchup with the Nets tonight. All good stuff, so we have a lot. But Teague, right now, this has been one of the tougher topics to tackle for you and I. Not that we're reticent to give opinions, but there's just not, you know, it's a lot of conjecture. We're not lawyers, so we needed to enlist one, and nobody better at this than Amy Dash, who has been a rock star on social media. You know, I've seen a lot of things, been on a lot of shows around the country. She's our CBS Sports legal analyst, and we've got some questions, and Amy, who is also a big Knicks fan and a really cool person, is with us here on Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio. Amy, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing so much better after that introduction. I'm so flattered. I really appreciate you guys having me on and all your kind words.
We need it. Listen, if you weren't really good, we wouldn't have you on. So what's, you know that, you know
my
how the
charm,
business.
My charm and my looks won't carry me, I guess.
Maybe we'll throw you on for a couple of minutes, but it wouldn't be a full segment if you weren't a lawyer. But listen, this is what's been very hard to determine. You know, you look at, and as every, seemingly every day for about a 2-week period, more and more and more, you know, claims from Busby, who obviously represents the women in this case. I didn't know where to draw the line. Like, okay, first of all, you've got to be fair to Deshaun Watson and the alleged victims as well. But is it a fetish? Is it just deviant behavior? Is he a predator? Is this a lie? From the most benign starting point, take us from the beginning and walk us through how you saw this from day one to where we are right now.
Oh, well, I think you're absolutely right. So starting on day one, I also tried to reserve judgment, which is really technically what's supposed to happen, but obviously it's difficult in the court of public opinion, especially when most of this stuff is playing out on social media. But, you know, eventually, I should say initially, there was one complaint filed. It was a civil lawsuit alleging sexual assault. And then all of a sudden, it was like dominoes falling. Just more and more women started filing their suits until, astoundingly, it went up to 22 women. And I think one just withdrew because the judge requires them to now go public with their names. But I think you're right. I mean, the main question is, was this a fetish, or was Deshaun Watson actually forcing himself on these women? And I think that's something that is still too early to tell. And especially following Rusty Hardin's press conference, I think if you look at the pattern of the allegations in the civil lawsuits, where it's very much the same in all of them, or almost all of them, I should say, where he's getting these massage people in a room, and then they're alleging that he's naked and he gets aroused and he tries to touch their hands with his genitals. And then some of them escalate into more serious conduct, which is a felony. So the question is he somebody who could force through either physical force, through coercion, threats, intimidation, manipulation? Is that the type of person that he is? Starkly different from the reputation that he had prior to all this. Mm-hmm. Or was he a man who had a fetish and didn't realize that his maneuver of making a suggestion towards these women was actually a crime?
Yeah, and Amy, it brings up the question, why none of this, at least I know there's a criminal investigation in at least one of these cases, but why isn't this been more of a criminal investigation than a civil one?
Well, so a lot of people ask that question of why did women go to the civil attorney first instead of going directly to the police? And this is actually quite common in these types of cases. Actually, Tony Busby had an expert at his press conference that said 90% of women never go to the police and report it. Of those who do, maybe 7% go through the process, and most of them result in plea deals for the accused. So most sexual assault cases don't go through the criminal process first, if at all. And a lot of times on the civil side, you have more control over what happens. And sometimes women can maintain their anonymity and they can get monetary compensation because maybe they don't want to have to go on the stand or, in the case of a famous athlete, have to go through all the public scrutiny of it.
So we're talking to AB Dash, who is our legal analyst here on Tiki and Tierney, the entire network, CBS Sports Radio, obviously. And she's been on top of this from minute one. Must follow on Twitter, must follow on Instagram. And as somebody who went to law school, as somebody who is a lawyer, what has been your opinion from the outset of the tactics by both lawyers? So from Busby's point of view, I watched the stream on Facebook when this initially dropped a couple of weeks ago. That is a very aggressive play. I don't know if it was the right or the wrong play. You would have more intel on that. And then contrast that to the way Harden has represented publicly, the words, the posturing. Are you impressed with one a little bit more than the other? What jumps out about the tactics of the lawyers?
I think the tactics of Busby are designed to do two things. One, to empower these women to have more influence over a potential settlement, if in fact any of them want to settle, because he had mentioned that he initially reached out to Deshaun Watson's people to settle, and he was sort of dismissed in a way that he felt was arrogant, and he was rejected. He was insulted, and he made this statement that he publicized, basically saying, you don't know who you're dealing with in Texas. Maybe this guy should get himself a lawyer. Sometimes, even, you know, this whole case aside, if you have alleged victims who don't have money, who don't have power, and they're going up against a powerful person, it does help to bring it into the public sphere, because now all of a sudden you've got that person's attention. So I think that's, you know, that's his strategy. And on the flip side, if you're talking about Harden, I think Harden is sort of at the mercy of Busby. Busby's also trying to influence the court of public opinion, because ultimately, if you think about a jury that's going to decide anything in a civil or criminal context, they're coming from the public. So if you can influence the court of public opinion, then you're going to have a hard time finding a juror that doesn't have an opinion, that isn't biased.
Yep.
And that might play to the victim's favor.
Yeah. So he's so he's basically planting seeds if this goes to court.
Right, because gotcha. look at the public opinion. It's so intense right now. There is so much damaging information out there. Mm-hmm. And then you had the presser where the victim came forward and she was crying. I mean, reputationally, it's very damaging. And there is this perception that he's guilty from, I would say, more people than not, even though all of the evidence hasn't come forward. And that's why Harden came out and said, listen, we want the names of these women. And by the way, he said at the press conference, we don't want you hazing the women. We're not trying to open the women up to threats and intimidation and harassment. But I'll tell you that I believe that's not necessarily true. I think he does want public pressure on the women, because at least one of the women has already withdrawn her lawsuit. Mm. And he was offered the names of these victims without they could have put a seal on it. They didn't have to make it public. And he said, no, I want the names public. I think there is an element to that of we want to put pressure on these women to either withdraw or so that the public will come out and start to offer us information about them. If people out there know damning information about them and they side with Deshaun Watson, maybe they'll start calling our office and telling us things that we can use in our own investigation to find out their motives.
Yeah, Rusty Harden, who is Deshaun Watson's lawyer, what kind of defense can he mount right now for Deshaun Watson? Because it does feel like all the momentum is pushing against him.
It is, and that's why I think he's throwing everything up against the wall and seeing what will stick. So he's saying consent. He's saying that there was at least one attempt of blackmail. And I think his overarching strategy, and that's why the press conference is so critical, is to really use Deshaun Watson's prior reputation to paint a picture of a guy that could never in his life force a woman to do anything, that would never use his physical power, that would never use his money and fame to force himself on people. And I think that's going to be the difference, is whether the jury believes that Deshaun Watson was just somebody who, you know, had a massage fetish and maybe committed some misdemeanors and touched people because he was trying to be suggestive and see if they would go for it, versus a Deshaun Watson who came in calculating, who used his physical force, who made intimidation and threats. Is he capable of becoming that type of person?
Yeah.
And I think, or is he that person behind the scenes? And I think Harden did a good job, at least at the presser, of putting doubt in people's minds about that.
Now, Amy, how do you even prove that? Like, how do you prove, like, that he forced himself? Like, it's his word versus someone else's word. How do you prove this?
Exactly. You can't. And that's why they had some women there at the presser who say they've known Deshaun Watson his whole life, and he's not this type of person. He wants to clear his reputation. And they also had 18 women who are in the massage industry come out and say this isn't him. So it's completely based on character witnesses. There's no way to prove it.
Yeah. You know what, though? I didn't love the tactic of bringing the other 18 masseuses out there, because it creates a thread of an unnatural amount of massage visits. Right?
Which is incriminating in and of itself. Yeah. I shouldn't say that it
perceptually
suggests that he does it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look good.
No, yeah. It doesn't at all. I mean, we're talking about 40 in a year, 40 different masseuses.
Yeah, that's odd. Not the number of massages, but the
different
of masseuses.
Type. Correct.
Yeah, no, correct. That makes sense. Amy, what should the NFL do here? We know that they have an investigation. They generally don't wait for a criminal case, or even in this case, a civil case, to be adjudicated. They base it on their own investigation. What should they do here? Wait, or should they pass down judgment prior?
Oh, I think they have to wait. They have to, because, first of all, they do typically wait to see if there are going to be criminal charges, because they don't want to do anything in their investigation that could interfere with a law enforcement investigation. And they did this with the Tyreek Hill accusations of child abuse. They waited to see what the outcome would be. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a lot of backlash when they rushed to judgment with Ezekiel Elliott and he wasn't criminally charged. And they came to the conclusion that he had abused a woman, which is a crime. And they came to that conclusion through their own investigators and their own adjudication system. There was way too much backlash. So I think they're just taking it easy now and they're conducting their investigation, but in a way that won't interfere with what's going on with the police department.
Amy, I've got one more for you on my end, and we're talking to Amy Dash, CBS Sports legal analyst here on Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio, of course, simulcast on CBS Sports Network. And this was a thread early, and I haven't heard much about it since, which leads me to believe that there was some pursuit of the answer. Otherwise, I don't think it would have gone away, but I want to lean on your expertise for this, because the connection that was trying to be made by some early, well, you know, Busby is neighbors with McNair, who owns the Texans, and Deshaun Watson's trying to wiggle his way out of Houston, and maybe this is some sort of elaborate scheme to take down his character, to pay him back, which to me seemed way too elaborate to actually happen. But because that was out there, did anybody actually, I don't even know if investigate's the right word, but probe into the relationship between Busby and McNair? Because to me that was initially interesting, and then the interest just dissipated. But to me that was an important part of the early equation. What happened with that?
Yeah, I was surprised that got so much steam initially. So Busby came out and he just flat out dispelled that and said that they're neighbors, but he doesn't know the guy. He wouldn't recognize him if he saw him in the street. He doesn't follow the Texans. And that actual rumor came from a post that he had put up that said, the McNairs are my neighbors, and look at this billboard that I paid $10,000 to try to convince them to bring in Johnny Manziel. And it's like, well, if you're such good friends with them, why are you spending $10,000 to try to get their attention with a billboard? And then later he came out and he said, there's no connection. And I just don't see how it would serve the Texans to have to pay this guy and have him on the roster and not be able to use him while a criminal process potentially could play out and go on for months or years. So I really don't think there's anything to that.
Yeah, okay.
I think you're right. You know, one other issue, this is non-Deshaun Watson, but Aaron Donald apparently got into a fight. Someone may be pressing charges.
Who's dumb enough to fight him, by the way?
That's a good point.
But, not me.
But I know that the details are still emerging here. You know, what could the NFL do with Aaron Donald? Are they going to start, I don't know, potentially investigating, suspending guys if they just get into some altercation with someone on the street or at a bar?
That's an interesting question. I don't necessarily have the answer for that, but you're right. It was like a bar fight or at a nightclub. And the guy was beat up pretty bad. I saw that he had multiple injuries. And it says he wants to press charges. A lot of times when that happens, they'll just straight go the civil route to try to get money out of the player. Yeah. But I think because he's a high-profile person, I think the NFL does have to do some sort of investigation. And certainly if there are criminal charges, they probably will look into it and maybe issue a small suspension. I don't see it being a big thing.
Yeah.
I don't see him being suspended for more than a couple games.
Okay. Well, you know, the Donald stuff is the you know, a little bit of the appetizer. We all know the main course right now, the main offseason story in the NFL is Deshaun Watson and not going away anytime soon. We needed somebody with a legal voice and real true background and intel, and you provided that. Very informative, great way to navigate it for our audience. And again, you have to follow Amy on social media, Instagram, she's very active. Twitter, she's very active. Amy-CBS Sports Legal Analyst. Outstanding work, Amy. Good. It's been a while, but really great spot. Good to have you back on the show.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I'm going to go watch my daughter play softball right now. That's
nice.
Strike to your heart, right?
Nice. And by the way, then tonight, you're going to watch the Knicks win again. I know you're going to watch our Knicks tonight, right?
Oh, my gosh. I've been so excited by the Knicks. I can't contain my excitement on social media. I am taking credit for R.J. Barrett's increased three-point goal field goal percentages.
Uh-huh.
I'm taking credit for that.
Why?
Because I was hazing him in the beginning. I got a lot of flack from Knicks fans that follow me. I was criticizing him because I said, yeah, he's great at assists, you know, defense, he's wonderful, he's putting up points across the board, except he's weak with his 3 points. I think his field goal percentage on his 3-point shot is like 30-something%.
Uh-huh.
I said, if this guy can master that, then he's going to be a triple threat. And people are like, oh, he's improved so much. What's wrong with holding this guy to a higher standard?
Nothing.
So I stood my ground, and he's been incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He's been hitting his threes and sometimes threes at the end of the game that are clutch 3-point shots that we desperately need because the games have been so close. So taking a little bit of credit for that.
And I was taking some slack too because, you know, when you're shooting 23% from downtown and you're the third overall pick, as he was at one point, he missed, I think, 19 in a row early in the season. He's flipped it around. Now we're getting off the beaten path. We could talk Knicks all day, but the main story here with us was Watson. But again, enjoy another Knick win tonight. We'll talk to you soon, Amy.
Thanks
you
so much. Bye-bye, guys.
You got it. There you go. So very vivid picture drawn by Amy. Follow her on social media, as I said. Teak, let's get to this coming up next. You know, I love the experiment that baseball, the lower levels of the minor leagues, they have used that as a laboratory to see what works, see what doesn't. What they're getting ready to test again is definitely radical, but by most accounts could really change the way the game looks. We'll get to that coming up next. I'm looking forward to it. Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio. All right, Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio, CBS Sports Network. So, one thing we know about baseball is that they know they've got to tweak a couple of things, right? They know that, and that's why they use the lower levels of the minors, Teak, to, you know, kind of serve as their little laboratory of sorts, and whether it's pace of play, which is, you know, the general thing that they're chasing, but also an alarming amount of inaction. I was reading an article. Let me give you this before we tell you about this proposed change.
Mm-hmm.
So, thus far, 37.1% of all plate appearances this season have ended either in a strikeout, a walk, or a home run, where basically no one's moving, except if it's the home run, the guy who's jogging the bases.
Mm-hmm.
Strikeout, no one's moving. Walk, nobody's moving. Home run, one guy's moving. That is a lot of nothing, all right? Now, that's slightly up from last year. So this year, it's 37.1%, smaller sample. Last year was 36%, and it was 35% the year before that. So in the last 3 years, it's gone 35.1, 36, 37.1. Slight small increments, but when you flash back a decade ago, it was 29.2%. So in almost 10 years, it's gone up just about 8 percentage points of nothing happening. Mm-hmm. Far too much. Yeah. All right. So, baseball's experimenting with, or they will, once the independent Atlantic League starts. And they are considering pushing the rubber, and I'm sure by extension, the actual mound itself, back 12 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that seems like a really, really, really small thing.
Yeah, it's a foot. It's only a foot.
But to me, it's going to have some real interesting implications. One could be an unintended consequence, which could actually dissuade them from implementing this in the bigs at some point. And that's an inability for pitchers to adjust.
Hmm.
I mean, if you're used to popping the strike zone at a certain point, and that's not just throwing a fastball to a certain spot, but knowing when to release a ball so that the anticipated break on whatever secondary stuff you throw will eventually find the zone. Those 12 inches, I'm not saying that you can't reprogram the mind and the arm, but it might take a little while for that to sync up.
Yeah.
And that could be an issue.
It could be, but from a hitter standpoint, does this give you, in theory, more time to recognize
goodness.
Pitches? And, there's obviously going to be more contact and more home runs. But I don't know if there'd be more home runs.
I don't know that there'd be more home runs either. Let me spit it to you this way. Yeah. Teak, I'm going to give you 12 extra inches every single time that you touch the football.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a little 12 inches more wiggle room.
Yep.
You're going to have a few more yards?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course you are, because you're going to
see. No doubt about it. You're going to see it. You're going to see things quicker. And
correct.
Better. And more
correct.
Effectively, and more likely have better opportunities for big plays. Mm-hmm. But also, I think in baseball, why I think the home runs would maybe go down is because the ball slows down, even just a fraction more, right? And so batters are taking longer swings, and maybe, I don't know, just the contact is different. Mm-hmm. Now, they would probably adjust as well. But I don't know. I think this has an interesting bend to it. And when I first saw this story, I immediately sent it to you because
I didn't see it, of course, because I was kicked out of Slack.
You was kicked out of Slack. But it's like, what does this even mean? Like, how does this benefit anything other than a novelty fix to something that maybe in time fixes itself?
Well, that's why you won't see it get to the majors for a while, because you're going to have to take, a fair amount of track record here and get a sense of, is this thing even worth pursuing? Mm-hmm. And then you'd have to say, well, okay, if that's the case, do we now incorporate these changes to college?
Yeah.
Because the last thing you want to do is draft a kid or draft kids. And now basically change the dimensions of the field unnecessarily. I mean, if there's a transitional process, you want to do that. I don't know if you move it up or move it back 12 inches in high school because the arm's still developing. I mean, that's a medical concern. So from college to the minors and pros, that's a performance point of view that I would be more concerned about. From high school and even earlier than that, clearly I'd be worried about the younger developing arms maybe being taxed in a way that they're not used to.
Now you got to throw harder. Is it? I mean, what's the physical?
I really think it no. I you wouldn't no no. Now the ball would get on the hitter slower because that's obvious. But the pitcher's not now. The pitcher might try to throw harder.
Yeah.
Sure, I think the real issue is with the breaking ball stuff. And here's the thing. My concern is I love the initiative because there's too much. Again, 37% of the time, no one's moving.
Yeah.
No one's moving.
It's stagnant.
And I tweeted this morning. It's a shame because the game's never been as athletic as it is now. I've been saying this for the 9 years we've been doing a show. I mean, the entire scouting template has changed. Back in the day, you had a lot of thick guys playing first base, thick guys playing third base, a couple of flat-footed mashers in the outfield, at least one of them. And now what they do is they, in essence, draft all shortstops, honestly.
Yeah.
And by attrition, all right, so we just drafted – I mean, you could draft pitchers too and outfielders, but or lefty first baseman and catchers. But say if an organization drafts – I'm just throwing out a number. What is it, about 49? 40, I know this year's been different. About 40 rounds-ish, I think 39. If you draft, say, you're going to always draft at least 15 pitchers. Say you draft, I don't know. You might draft 30-ish shortstops in a given year, right?
That's crazy.
Around the, and now of the 30, you'll put couple in left field, couple in center, couple in right, couple in second, couple in third, and obviously a few at short. And as they go, now some guys just can't hit and they're done after A ball, but for the guys who can hit, what you have is a more athletically explosive product when you get to the show, because everybody pretty much grew up as a shortstop rather than just grow as a conventional third baseman or right fielder, and you're faster. So the game is fast, and they need to show it off. And I think if they can sync up a strike zone that forces the hitters to swing a little bit more, right? And also simultaneously pushes it back, so the identification is advantage hitter, because they have 12 more inches to see what's coming. But the expanded, or at least the true strike zone, is actually enforced. It's now an advantage pitcher. I think it's kind of net-net, and you won't see this offensive explosion, and you won't see the pitchers getting crushed, but you will see more swings, which is the entire pursuit of this. Swings.
And at the end of the day, don't pitchers – I mean, not that they need any other incentive to, I don't know, diversify their repertoire, but doesn't that also happen? Like, you gotta start coming up with different and better pitching. And so in some ways, it almost it forces you as a pitcher to be better, right? As opposed to, all right, I know I can throw 100, right? And I know I have a nasty secondary pitch, one or two secondary pitches. But now you got to really get creative when you're looking at a hitter who now has more time to evaluate what you're trying to do to him.
So yeah.
It just changes things a little bit. It puts pressure on both sides.
I think it changes things a lot. I mean, I'm telling you, a lot of the times, I mean, 12 inches is, especially at that level, the determining factor is to whether or not you, there it is. I was going to say, the kids, they know not to touch daddy's baseball. I mean, if you have 12 extra seconds to determine the thread, is it, you know, the dot, which, you know, it actually becomes a dot. And guys like Gwynn and I mean, everybody, the majors can pick up the dot. But if you can pick that up 12 inches earlier, I mean, that is a distinct advantage. The other thing, and I might be overthinking this, but if you push somebody back 12 inches, think about how many bang-bang plays there are at first base, right? When balls are hit, I mean, not actual conventional squaring around and bunting, whether it's a push or a drag, but, you know, you hit a little topper or you hit a little bleeder and the pitcher jumps off the mound, he makes the play and he wheels, he throws to first. How many of those plays are bang-bang?
Yeah.
A lot of them, right?
A lot of them.
Well, if the pitcher's 12 inches back, that's 12 inches more. He's got to go get the baseball. And I don't know. Again, this is where I might be overthinking it. I do think you'll see a few more plays at first that are safe. But if you have real wheels, I mean real plus speed, it could incentivize a few people to bunt more. I don't know that you want to necessarily incorporate bunting too much. But yeah. I just think that these changes are interesting. And listen, if it fails on its face, fine.
You're right.
But the real issue here is that baseball is not standing pat. They know they've got great athletes. They know they've got a terrific product, but 37% of nothing is 37% of nothing.
Yeah.
And that's just too much. The average fan needs more action. That's why I always joke around with Teak when it's been a long time, but right before the pandemic, Jen and I went down to the Bahamas, where you guys went. Same exact place.
And
Baja Mar, which is a beautiful, beautiful spot. And, you know, go to the casino a little bit before dinner, play. I've always told Teak, I don't like roulette, nor do I really like, I'm not saying you can't win. I don't like roulette. I don't even really like poker because my mind works fast.
Yeah.
And I get bored sitting there holding cards, especially when I have nothing. And I get really bored when I see a little metal ball flowing around the circular tube waiting for it to finally dink and drop and to see if I win.
For 30 seconds.
I need action.
Yeah.
And I like the action. And I think that certainly correlates to watching sports, too. I look at, you know, baseball, even though I love it, baseball is much more like roulette or poker. Now, it's never going to become blackjack where there's always cards flipping. The nature of the game, inherently, it can never become that fast. But if you could speed it up just a little bit and make things happen a little bit more, I think that would be awesome. And I love the fact that they're pursuing it. So we'll
I'm
see
glad
what happens.
They're trying.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. They're trying. So you could ask. Try to stay ahead of the times, react to what people say about the sport. And they're doing that. Good for them. All right, Teak. Let's get the update from ACK. And We'll get that now. A little bit late. Axe update. Here's Rich Ackerman. A little baseball going on. Here we go. All right. Tiki and Tierney here, CBS Sports Radio. Hey, this weekend, the PGA Tour is back on CBS. Many of the world's top golfers descend on the famous Harbortown Golf Links course. It's in Hilton Head, South Carolina for the RBC Heritage. Always fun. Live coverage begins 3 Eastern, 12 Pacific, Saturday and Sunday only on CBS. All right. So, you know, under most circumstances, this would be one of the must-watch games of the NBA season. The Nets and the Sixers, you know, chasing down the top seed in the Eastern Conference and, you know, all the star power on both teams. It's a national game. ESPN, same exact records, identical. I believe each team has 37 wins, I think. I think it's 37, but they have the same exact records, and they're both chasing something. Doc Rivers, Steve Nash, high-profile names and players and resumes everywhere. Well, the only problem is most of those resumes are going to be on ice tonight. Listen, it's not James Harden's fault he got hurt, so we put him to the side. I'd personally like to see Kevin Durant play tonight. I mean, he's been out since February 13th, and he's come back. I believe he's played 3 games. In his first game, he only played 17 minutes or so, hit all 5 shots. Incrementally, they bumped him up. You know, he's been doing his thing. He's Kevin Durant. Kyrie Irving did not play in yesterday's, mop-the-floor game with the T-Wolves. They didn't need him. He is active tonight. Don't know if he's going to play. We'll see. I'd like to see Kyrie Irving out there. But ahead of the matchup, I thought this was really interesting. Ben Simmons. You don't hear Ben Simmons talk that much.
No, not that much, right? Never. Not like this.
Not that much. Well, he talked about the rivalry. We'll put quotes around the word rivalry with the Brooklyn Nets and a very sage perspective from the young player. Check it out.
Rivalry, I mean, if they keep that same team, definitely. But, you know, it's going to be hard to do that. But, no, we're going for the past champs, the Lakers. You know, they were the ones who won the championship, so you got to give respect to them. Obviously, Brooklyn, you know, has a lot of talent. But at the end of the day, you know, there's only one ball. You got to play defense, too. So we gotta come and prepare mentally and physically.
You know, he's very adept at, you know, throwing out a little zinger and not walking it back, not taking it back, but then kind of softening it with a transitional word, you know what I mean? Like kind of redirecting, but keeping that little diss. I got to play defense. Oh, it's only one ball. Now Lakers are the champs. I love that cut from Ben Simmons. That was great.
Yeah, that was pretty funny because he was – I mean, it was like a subtle jab, but it was profound. It wasn't like he went out of his way to, I don't know, make it loud and profound and specifically target the Nets. But he just kind of saying, look, they're a great offensive team. They have superstars all over the place offensively. But in the end of the day, you do got to make some stops if you're going to win on any level. And he's just pointing out the obvious. So good for him, man.
I love it. I think
you got to back it up, though.
For sure. Well, he backed it up the other night against Rudy Gobert when they played Utah. Let's get to this cut. Now he's on a little, you know, candidacy here. He's feeling himself. He's saying that he should win. I don't necessarily disagree that he should win the DPOY award. And he was talking about Rudy Gobert and his versatility, meaning Simmons' versatility, how he could play 1 through 5, and how Gobert checked him, and he sliced him for 40-plus. Listen to this.
I'm one of those guys who can guard 1 through 5. Obviously, there's a lot of respect for Rudy. You know, I know what he's capable of. I know, you know, he's great down there in the paint, but he's not guarding everybody. And that's just what it is. I mean, he guarded me in Utah.
And?
I had 42. And apparently, I'm not a scorer, so it is what it is. But, you know, I have a lot of respect for him at the same time. I think it's mine this year.
Now, I want to play that again because there is a lesson in there that I want all young journalism aspiring broadcasters to hear and to remember.
Rachel's the greatest. That was from the jump, obviously.
That was from the jump. Listen to the timing. Just the one word. And the timing and the insertion of the word by Rachel Nichols to make sure she knew he dropped 42. She wanted him to say, I don't think he says it if she doesn't. Go ahead, Diesel, one more time.
I'm one of those guys who can guard 1 through 5. Obviously, there's a lot of respect for Rudy. You know, I know what he's capable of. I know, you know, he's great down there in the paint, but he's not guarding everybody. And that's just what it is. I mean, he guarded me in Utah.
And?
I had 42.
There you go. That's it.
But, and? You know, I have a lot of respect for him at the same time. I think it's mine this year.
I mean, he is the master at, really, the more I hear the master at not even dissing, just pointing out something that he believes is obvious. Well, he's and by the way, he's right.
He's pointing out facts.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Lakers are the defending champion.
Yes.
There's only one ball to go around.
Mm-hmm. He did have to play defense.
You got to play defense. He did drop 42 on Rudy Gobert.
Yeah.
Rudy Gobert doesn't guard 1 through 5. Mm-hmm. These are all facts.
Yeah, you're right. And look, is he the defensive player of the year? If you're going to make it on, if you're going to judge it on versatility and what Ben Simmons is asked to do, it's hard not to. But we know that the defensive player of the year is it's who feels dominating in the paint, really. That's what it comes down to. I mean, every now and then you get one of the, you know, perimeter guys, especially if as a wing defender.
Pippen got a bunch. Yeah, no, yeah, I got you.
Exactly. But those wing defenders who sometimes they get help and they get blocks and steals because they're jumping in lanes and things of that nature. But, you know, it feels like as of late, it's been who's going to be around the rim protecting it, whether it's whether it was Giannis last year or Rudy Gobert, who didn't. He won it 2 years in a row, didn't he?
I believe Gobert did.
I think he did. But anyways, you know, you get the point. It's usually a who's defined as a big, like power forward or a center. It's hard to look at a point guard, but this point guard and Ben Simmons is one of the more unique point guards in basketball right now. So his defensive acumen is great. And the fact that he's going 42 against Rudy, which, by the way, was a season and I think maybe even career high, because he's only averaging like 23 points or so. Mm-hmm. He exploited Rudy big time. So yeah. He has the right to call him out, man.
Absolutely. You know, by the way, looking up the history of the Defensive Player of the Year Award, it's interesting too, because so the award was introduced in the early 80s, right? Mm-hmm. And as much as it's kind of morphed into a bigger, not necessarily, I mean, conventional centers are pretty much a thing of the past anyway, but it started the exact opposite. Sidney Moncrief, who was on those really good Buck teams back in the day, he won it twice. He was a shooting guard and really good. Then Mark Eaton won it, the monster from Utah Jazz. Like, he looks like he came out of a cave. That guy was huge, had the big beard. I think he is 7'4", I want to say Mark Eaton is. Then Alvin Robertson, you've heard me mention Alvin Robertson's name before. He won it with the Spurs. Then Michael Cooper won it, terrific defensive guard for the Lakers. Then MJ won it. So 5 of the first 6 years, it was guards. And then you start to see the Rodmans, the David Robinsons, the Olajuwons, the Mutombos, Gary Payton slipped
guys.
In. Gary Payton snuck in there. Then Ben Wallace was awesome.
Gary only won one.
Gary, I don't know the answer.
I mean, he's got the nickname.
I think Gary only won one. Yeah,
well, that's crazy.
Gary, almost, I'm going to say it was one. It was one for Gary Payton. Then Mutombo won it back to. It's funny, like when you win it, you usually win it a few years in a row. Like Mutombo won it twice in a row. Alonzo, this is in succession. Alonzo won it twice in a row. Hmm. Then Mutombo won it again. All right. Then Wallace won it twice in a row. Then Artest won it. Then Wallace won it twice in a row. Dwight Howard 3 times in a row. Like it's funny. Kawhi Leonard twice in a row. Gobert twice in a row. And you know, I don't think Giannis will win it this year. I think that I'm almost positive it's going to be Ben Simmons, to our point before. But, I mean, it's an award, quite frankly, I don't want to say I don't care about the Defensive Player of the Year Award, because so much of it is help and what you do on the pick and roll. You know, but Ben Simmons is something like if you're starting a team, if you're trying to start a foundation for a team, you want somebody with great vision. I'm not saying he's my first choice to start a franchise because he can't shoot.
Yeah.
But if you give me...
As a guard, as a shooter, as a scorer.
As a player. If you give me a guy who sees the court pretty much as well as anybody in the entire league, and he can defend any position on the court at 6'10", I mean, that's a guy, he should be one of the first bricks on a team. You're starting with a lot when you start with that.
Don't disagree. You just got to teach him how to score and at least try to shoot three-pointers.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't have his numbers in front of me this year. I can't imagine he's tried more than 15. D-Cell, look it up real quick, or Mike, if you can. I don't believe he's attempted more than 15 this year, and I'd say around, and I'd probably take the under if I had to.
Yeah.
15's my working number off the top of my head. It never takes him, still.
Yeah, it's just not in his repertoire. He's just not comfortable doing it. I mean, I understand.
But he looks comfortable in practice. And even when he lets it fly in the game once in a while,
he's taking nine.
Nine. Come on.
Nine.
Come on.
He's a guard in 2021. He's taking 9 3-pointers.
That's insane. What do you think the level of confidence for Net fans? That is let's flip it to them for a second.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting dynamic because, you know, at least the Sixers like fans, they know the mountain they've been climbing. A lot of it was, or some of it was maybe coaching. You know, Brent Brown, good coach, but flaws.
Yep.
stylistically, they had to alter a few things. They had to get another player. Which, you know, Seth Curry's a shooter. They modify things. The Nets and Sixer fans have seen that evolution. Net fans, the moment those two players signed before Harden came here, they're thinking championship right away.
Yep.
Right away, and rightfully so. And then you get Harden, but now they've only played 7 games together, the trio. And, you know, you don't really know exactly week to week where, and I'm not taking a shot, but it is what it is, where Kyrie's mindset is pertaining to the game. Durant's coming off Achilles, and now the hamstring's been barking since February. Like, does the Net fan have a license to be very confident right now? Rookie head coach?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, only because when one of these guys, if you forget two of them, are on, they are dominant. I mean, it was almost...
Well, dominant offensively.
Yes, offensively.
Don't stop anybody.
Yes. Yeah, they don't... But they, I mean, do you need to? If you score,
yes.
If you score 130?
In the,
you know,
in the championship, in the finals, you got to get some stops.
Yeah, I mean, but it depends
on... In the conference finals, you got to get some
stops.
It
depends on who you end up matching up against. Now, if it ends up being the 76ers, then the Nets are likely going to have some issues because the 76ers actually play defense. But if the 76ers, for whatever reason, as we've seen in previous seasons, get knocked out, you know, premature of the Eastern Conference Finals, if I'm the Nets fan, I'm ecstatic. Anybody but the Sixers, I think I'm okay with. We know that the Bucks, as much as we like them,
well, you like them more than me. I don't think
they're
going
anywhere. That's why I say ish, like them ish. You know that they're going to be had at some point because of I don't even know why. I can't even put my finger on it, but. The Sixers would be the one team that would worry me if I'm the Nets.
I agree with that.
They're so big, right? And Tobias Harris has turned into such a good scorer for them. Even if Ben Simmons isn't, you know, dropping 30, they have three scorers who can make a difference on both sides of the court.
There's a lot of enticing potential NBA Finals matchups, but, you know, the more I think about this, I don't know how it gets juicier than if you have LeBron and AD healthy and they somehow, you know, piece it together and get out of the way. And if they're healthy, they probably will, versus the Nets trio, especially the whole underlying LeBron-Kyrie stuff.
Yeah.
How sick would that be?
Yeah. I mean, we haven't heard much about that. I wonder if it's still a thing.
Yeah, I just think that...
I don't know.
I don't think they're boys. I mean,
I don't
put
think
that
they
way.
Are either, but I wonder if it's still a thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think so.
When you're chasing
maybe.
The same thing, old flare-ups have a tendency to arise again. Third hour coming up.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.